Now a few stats on Brittany Griner, 23 years old, 6 feet 8 inches tall. She's one of the best female basketball players in the world. She's so good, the owner of a men's team, the Dallas Mavericks, said he'd love to recruit her. Griner's also co-authored a memoir that comes out today. NPR's Netta Ulaby talked with her about being tall, playing ball, and coming out at a college where homosexuality is banned.
Brittany Griner was, understandably, the top draft pick last year for the Women's National Basketball Association. In college, she set records for the most block shots in a season and the most career blocks ever for male or female players. You can see highlights on YouTube from Griner's first season with her team, the Phoenix Mercury, like a decisive slam dunk followed by a triumphant swing off the rim.
No other woman who plays basketball can do that. Two-handed, 2 feet, just goes up.
Griner is taller than a lot of the guys who play in the NBA. She's taller than 99% of the American population. In her book, she writes about being bullied and taunted since middle school for her height, athleticism, and deep voice.
I mean, growing up, I always got, she's a man, or she plays too hard, or there's just no way that she can be that good because, you know, a girl can't do that. And I struggle with it a little bit. I'm like, well, am I going too hard? And I just realized, like, I'm a competitor. I want to go as hard as I can. And if I look like a guy out there playing ball, well, hey, I feel sorry for the opponent.
She plays with a kind of emancipated abandon.
Sports writer Dave Zirin likens Griner's talent to that of Wilt Chamberlain and LeBron James. But he says her openness about sports sexism and homophobia makes her equally as formidable off the courts.
She represents a break from the sexual McCarthyism in women's sports.
Griner came out as a lesbian while playing at Baylor University in Texas. There she was a much beloved star. But she had no idea her school had a policy against homosexuality until her coach urged her to keep quiet about it. Shortly before leaving college, Griner disclosed her sexuality to Sports Illustrated and ESPN. Now she's made it something of a mission to address closet culture in women's sports.
I had a girl come up and tell me how her coach basically told them that they could not be gay on their team. And I've heard stories of some coaches will not recruit you if you are.
Griner resists expectations of how well women can play ball and traditional standards of beauty. Her distinctive sense of style impresses even sports writers who don't really care about such things, including Dave Zirin.
She dresses like a 1920s male dandy, and it's pretty amazing to see. I don't know anybody who pulls off Argyle socks quite like Brittany Griner.
Griner's got shoulder-length braids, tons of tattoos, but when it comes to fashion, Ellen DeGeneres is her role model.
Because it shows that we're not just big baggy clothes, butch.
Now, Griner identifies as butch. I asked her. Not many well-known women do. Griner's redefining butch fashion so well, when Nike endorsed her as its first openly gay athlete, the company asked her to model its menswear line.
It looks a little bit better on me, honestly, than some of the tighter female clothes.
Even so, Griner was surprised in a recent WNBA meeting where players were shown possible new uniforms.
The shorts came in short or extra short.
Part of a plan to attract more men to the games by making players' outfits sleek and sexy.
As soon as I heard that sleek and sexy, I was like, excuse me, I play basketball?
It's basketball that brings in Griner's fans. Last year, attendance at Phoenix Mercury home games shot up more than 30%. And ESPN2 decided to keep broadcasting women's professional basketball partly because of her popularity. Griner says her celebrity today would have been unimaginable to the middle school kid who once thought suicide might be better than being teased constantly about her gender nonconformity and her size.
Now I want to stand out. I want to show off how big I am. I want to show off, you know, my long arms, my big hands, just loving myself. It's just a place of peace.
Brittany Griner's memoir is called In My Skin. It was co-written by Sue Hovey. It's a glimpse of what it's like to live in the athlete's size 17 men's shoes. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Stay with us for more All Things Considered from NPR News. Now we're going to take you from Back to the Future, The Twilight Zone, to Doctor Who. The theme of time travel is timeless in movies, TV, and books. What is it about time travel that is just so darn appealing?
it is very common when you think about time travel of people wanting to go back into the past and to change something to make it better.
That's Anne Vandermeer. She's co-editor of the Time Traveler's Almanac, a new anthology of short stories by some of the best sci-fi writers. Now, forget saving the world or preventing the next natural disaster. Nope. She says characters are mostly concerned with changing their love lives.
Originally, when we were approaching this, we thought that it was going to be pretty much adventure, science fiction, that type of a anthology, but we found basically a lot of love stories. I had read something somewhere when H.G. Wells was first writing The Time Machine and War of the Worlds. Those types of stories were actually called science romance. They were not called science fiction. That term didn't come until years later, and it really kind of struck me. Yeah, that actually kind of fits in a way. When you take a look at all these stories, you think it's really about the gee whiz, look at all these cool gadgets and all these wonderful science fictional things. But when you come right down to it, all of these stories really are about people connecting with people and trying to understand themselves better.
One of those stories that you're talking about is called The House That Made the 16 Loops of Time. Tell us a little bit about it.
You have this older woman. And she's been living in this magic house. And, you know, weird things happen when you live in a magic house. You know, not terrible things, but strange things happen. And she's been used to it after living there for so many years. But then something really strange happens to her where the house keeps rebooting and taking her back in time, maybe an hour. It's like rebooting to this certain moment over and over again. And it was the house's way of telling her that she really needed to change her life. She was in a rut. She needed to make a decision about a particular romantic relationship in her life. And the house was basically giving her a kick in the butt, saying, hey, you need to be looking at this. So I love that story.
It's very Groundhog Day, right?
Yeah, it was kind of Groundhog Day. But what's really interesting is things don't always come out the way that you think they're going to.
Right. Essentially, it never seems to work, which seems to speak to these rules of time travel that have emerged in the writing.
Yes. Yes. And I think what's really funny is that all the rules that you think that there are, they got broken along the way. When my husband and I first started doing research to put this book together, we had four sections of how we were going to organize the book. But when we were done, it's very interesting that all the rules that you think you know about time travel just got broken by all these stories. And the thing that's great about that is that it doesn't really matter. The bottom line when you're reading the stories is you're saying to yourself, is this a good story? Was I entertained? Did I come away and go, wow? Because in the end, fiction really is the most effective time travel machine in the universe, and it always has been.
Anne, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Anne Vandermeer is co-editor of the Time Traveler's Almanac. That story she told us about is called The House That Made the 16 Loops of Time by Tamsin Muir.
The author Peter Matheson died yesterday at the age of 86 after a struggle with leukemia. The novelist and naturalist was the only writer to ever win National Book Awards in both fiction and adult nonfiction. And his life contained many facets beyond writing. He co-founded the Paris Review, but he was also a political activist, world explorer, Buddhist teacher, and briefly, a spy. His latest work is a novel called In Paradise, which we heard about yesterday on Weekend Edition. Tom Vitale visited Matheson at the author's home on Long Island. Here's his appreciation.
In his first nonfiction book, Peter Matheson staked out the territory he would revisit the rest of his life, the destruction of nature and natural peoples at the hands of mankind. Wilderness in America, published in 1959, is a history of the extinction of animal and bird species in North America.
Species appear, and left behind by a changing earth, they disappear forever. And there is a certain solace in the inexorable. But until man, the highest predator, evolved, the process of extinction was a slow one. No species but man, as far as is known, unaided by circumstance or climactic change, has ever extinguished another.
Wilderness in America led to a series of assignments from The New Yorker that in turn led to a series of books. Matheson traveled to New Guinea in 1961 with Michael Rockefeller, who disappeared and may have been the victim of headhunters. He wrote about trips to Africa, the Himalayas, South America, and Antarctica. But he said he never intended to write nonfiction.
Fiction is my first love, and it's the way I began. And frankly, when I began nonfiction, I did it for money.
That's kind of like Babe Ruth wanting to be remembered as a pitcher.
McKay Jenkins is the author of The Peter Matheson Reader and several nature books of his own, including Poison Spring.
Matheson is held in such high regard as a nonfiction writer by nonfiction writers that they sometimes say, well, how is it possible that this guy can be such a virtuoso fiction writer and give his equally substantial body of nonfiction work such short shrift, because all the rest of us are trying to do what we can to mimic his nonfiction work.
Matheson was remarkable in a lot of ways. He was born in Manhattan in 1927 to a wealthy family. After a stint in the Navy, he attended Yale, where he began writing short stories, and where one of his professors recruited him into the CIA. In 1953, Matheson co-founded what would become one of the most important literary magazines of the 20th century, the Paris Review. But he did it as a cover for his CIA activities. He said it was the only adventure in his long life he ever regretted.
I was a spy. When I went in there, it was the end of the Cold War. Russia was a great menace out there in the distance. It was considered very patriotic to join the CIA. I didn't know my politics were going to veer leftward and that I would really come to despise the CIA.
Matheson's politics led to a lifelong career as an activist. He wrote books about union organizer Cesar Chavez, the Native American movement, and the disappearing fishermen on eastern Long Island.
I go along with Albert Camus, who famously said, "The responsibility of the writer is to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves." And that's always been kind of my informal motto.
For all of his books advocating conservation, Matheson saw the destruction of the environment accelerate over his lifetime.
I can hardly point to a victory we ever won as conservationists that hasn't been overturned. But we won some, too. There were long-lasting victories. And if nothing else, we stalled them off. The developers and exploiters.
If the victories didn't last, the writing does, says author McKay Jenkins.
Matheson didn't like being called a nature writer. That said, I don't think there's a living nature writer that hasn't been profoundly influenced by Matheson's work. Whether you're talking about Terry Tempest Williams or Barry Lopez or Annie Dillard, I mean, Bill McKibben, you could list any nature writer of any consequence owes a great debt to Matheson.
After Peter Matheson's wife, Deborah, died of cancer in 1972, he embraced Zen Buddhism and eventually became a priest and teacher. In his 1978 book, The Snow Leopard, Matheson wrote about a spiritual journey in the remote mountains of Nepal and the impossibility of capturing experience in words.
The sun is round. I ring with life, and the mountains ring. And when I can hear it, there's a ringing that we share. I understand all this. Not in my mind, but in my heart, knowing how meaningless it is to try to capture what cannot be expressed, knowing that mere words will remain when I read it all again another day.
For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
Writing a biography of John Updike might pose a problem. The acclaimed American writer of elegant essays and elegiac novels and short stories may have been a genius, but he was also disconcertingly normal. He liked to drink, but wasn't a drunk. He had three marriages, but wasn't a womanizer. He could be wistful, but rarely depressed. He was a straight white Christian man who liked golf. How do you write a book about an artist like that? Adam Begley, who was books editor of the New York Observer and has written for many publications, has produced a prodigious biography of the man who's often considered the most accomplished American writer. The book is simply Updike. Adam Begley joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Tell us the story. John Updike was the first guy to make you laugh?
Yeah, that's a story that my parents told me all through my childhood. My father and John were classmates at college, and they were living in Cambridge, and John dropped by one afternoon, and apparently I was sitting in a little baby chair, and there was a bowl of fruit next to it, and John picked up three oranges and started juggling, and apparently I laughed in a deep baby way, and it was the first time I laughed, and that's what I'd been told all my life.
How did growing up in Shillington, Pennsylvania, form John Updike's view of the world? He thought of it as a big city.
Well, he thought of it as a complete world and the center of the universe. It was a very settled place when he was growing up, though he was born during the Depression and World War II followed shortly thereafter. There was in Shillington, in his world, very little change, and that stability meant a lot to him. Shillington was in an interesting place in the American cosmos, which is it was that little town on the edge of a bigger city called Reading, Pennsylvania, and it was sort of trapped between the urban world and the rural world. Mm-hmm. And encroaching city meant that it might possibly have seemed to him in some ways stable but endangered, a lifestyle that couldn't last.
How does somebody come out of Harvard and become the quintessential New Yorker writer?
Well, he once described the New Yorker voice, that we, as a bunch of dazed farm boys who were dazzled and delighted by New York. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, you want to be a little tiny bit of an outsider if you want to get that quintessential New York voice. So yeah. In some ways he was perfect, but the real answer to that question, I guess, is that he was so unbelievably adept with his writing, and he could mimic almost any tone. And when he saw what the right tone was for the New Yorker, he did it infallibly every time.
Yeah. I want to draw you out on what certainly you are in league with a lot of critics and wise readers who consider his signature work to be Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux, Rabbit is Rich, Rabbit at Rest, Rabbit Remembered. What do they represent, the Harry Angstrom story, in English language literature?
If you look at them as a unit, they are one of the most complete expressions of a society in all its workings. He captured the entirety of America from 1960 to 1990, which is an extraordinary achievement to do in four novels and a short story. He did it by creating an everyman that most of us can relate to, inhabiting him thoroughly, and allowing that every man's senses to be totally open to the American experience. Rabbit really captured America.
Could you tell me the Tootsie Roll story?
Well, Updike never really believed in teaching writing classes, but in a moment of weakness in 1962, he agreed to teach a writing class at Harvard. And so for about 8 weeks, he went in and taught a room full of a dozen kids what he knew about writing. And one day he brought in a letter that he had received from the Tootsie Roll Company of America, thanking him for having mentioned Tootsie Rolls in the Rabbit books. He read this letter, which was a form letter from the company and very pompous about Tootsie Rolls. And he put down the letter when he'd finished and he said, "And that are the rewards of being a writer in America."
What about the notion some critics had that Updike was a writer who could produce gorgeous prose, but in the end didn't say that much?
I think that that's the easiest club to pick up and try and beat Updike with, and I'm never convinced with it. When I read deeply in Updike, which is really the best way to read Updike, is to immerse yourself. I'm struck by the beauty of his sentences always. You can't miss it. But what he hits when he's on top of his game is deep truths about the American soul, and not just politics, but personally. I mean, when his stories hit you, you realize that you are being targeted individually. There's something very specific about his voice talking to you. Mm-hmm. When he hits nostalgia, for example, you realize that suddenly that you are nostalgic the way his characters are.
I know he was the first man to make you laugh when he juggled. Would he have been a nice guy to have dinner with?
Absolutely charming. Updike was one of the most charming men I've ever met. He was charming in his attention to you and in his ability to keep you at just a little arm's length. Mm-hmm. He would make you laugh. He would tell you things that you didn't know, and he would find out everything about you. You would be aware that he was noticing you with terrific intensity. And you might find even that he'd put you in a story next time.
Adam Begley, his new biography, Updike. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The writer Lydia Davis has released a new collection of short stories. Some so short, they are just one or two lines.
This one is called Contingency versus Necessity. He could be our dog, but he is not our dog. So he barks at us.
That's Lydia Davis reading from her book, Can't and Won't. It's the latest from a writer who has won some of literature's most prestigious awards, including the Man Booker Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant. Davis comes from a distinguished literary family. Her parents were both writers and teachers. I asked her when she began to realize that she didn't need to write long in order to write well.
I can date that pretty precisely to the fall of 1973. So I was 26 years old, and I had just been reading the short stories or the prose poems of Russell Edson. And for some reason, I was sparked by those. I thought, these are fun to read and provocative and interesting, and I'd like to try this. So I set myself the challenge of writing two very short stories every day just to see what would happen. Hmm.
The title of your book is Can't and Won't, which is the title of one of the stories in the collection. Would you mind reading that piece?
Be happy to. I was recently denied a writing prize because they said I was lazy. What they meant by lazy was that I used too many contractions. For instance, I would not write out in full the words cannot and will not, but instead contracted them to can't and won't.
Did this happen to you? Were you rejected from a writing prize because of your contractions?
It would have been very funny if I had been. That would have been a very peculiar reason. But it was a dream, and I thought it was a great dream, so I wrote it down.
It has particular resonance, though, with your history, because you did grow up in a family that put a premium on language and grammar. I imagine that if this were to have happened, that it would have been quite an insult that someone would suggest that your choice of words was lazy. Is that something you would take personally?
I might have when I was in my early 20s or teens. At this point, I would find it so outrageous that I would almost enjoy it.
So my question out of that is, how do you know when to stop? Because I read that story and I thought, well, that's an interesting moment. But that could also be the beginning of a novel or a longer essay. How do you know when an idea is fully fleshed out?
I think I have a sense right in the beginning of how big an idea it is and how much room it needs. And almost more importantly, how long it would sustain anybody's interest. And that's sometimes been a problem with a story when it's sort of offered me two ways that it could go, and I have to choose one or the other.
Do you ever go back to make something longer or to shorten something?
Sometimes. The last story in the book called PhD is really only one line long, and that started as, say, a paragraph.
Can you read that one? Or perhaps you can recite that from memory.
I wouldn't dare. All these years, I thought I had a PhD, but I do not have a PhD. A friend of mine had that dream, who does safely and securely have a PhD, but she would dream over and over, you know, that there was one crucial exam she had not taken.
You do include a couple longer pieces. The longest, I believe, is about 20 pages or so, called The Letter to the Foundation.
Yes.
Can you explain the gist of that story?
The plot is that a woman, and I think of her as a sort of sad academic, she's been given a much coveted grant and thinks that, sort of unrealistically, that now she will be able to stop teaching. Teaching is very difficult for her. And, of course, that's modeled on my own experience. I find teaching I like it, but it's I find just walking into the classroom and facing the students very difficult.
She does seem sad, and she seems absolutely desperate to find some kind of lifeline out of the teaching profession. Were you ever that desperate to get out of teaching?
Oh, yes. A lot of that was exactly echoing my own feelings and riding up on the bus. I insisted on taking a bus rather than my car, I don't know why, to the university and wishing there'd be a minor accident, you know, flat tire or something. Nobody would get hurt, but somehow it would prevent the class happening.
Why?
As I say, that stage fright was enormously difficult.
Ah, stage fright.
Yeah, the 5 or 10 minutes before the class were agony.
Leslie, I'd like to ask you about the idea of inspiration, kind of pegged to your story called Not Interested. Could you summarize the narrator's state of mind in this piece?
It starts almost with her little job of carrying sticks to the woodpile in the backyard, a job that she normally doesn't mind in some kind of philosophical, meditative way. But really, one day, she's just infinitely bored by it, can't stand to do it, and doesn't do it. And I'm making a parallel here with certain kinds of reading and writing in the literary world. Just, she's tired of it. And I was a little worried about this piece because it's so negative about writing. And
it is.
Perhaps I should have left it in a drawer. I don't know.
Would you mind reading the last paragraph of that story?
Okay. Actually, I don't mean I'm bored by old novels and books of stories, if they're good. Just new ones, good or bad. I feel like saying, please spare me your imagination. I'm so tired of your vivid imagination. Let someone else enjoy it. That's how I'm feeling these days, anyway. Maybe it will pass. Well, at least I say let someone else enjoy it. I can imply that it may be enjoyable and it's just me. I think that's what it really was.
How do you get over those bouts?
They just pass by themselves. Mm. I mean, I say in the course of the story sort of apologetically, I think, well, sometimes I get tired of my own thoughts, too. And I suppose then you want to be able to go into a truly meditative state where your mind is empty. That would be nice.
Isn't that a little dangerous for a writer? I mean, at the end of the day, you have to believe that you're thinking big thoughts. You're thinking something that is going to inspire someone. If you get sick of yourself and what's going on in your head, how do you keep writing?
Well, it doesn't last long. I mean, it's a very momentary thing.
The writer Lydia Davis, her new collection of short stories is called Can't and Won't. She joined us from our studios in New York. Lydia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us and share your readings.
It was very nice. Thank you.